The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder, is it really wrong to visit a medium or conduct a seance to contact a friend or loved one who has passed away? Christians have told you that the Bible forbids that kind of stuff, that any supernatural, paranormal activity is actually coming from God's enemy, Satan, who seeks to confuse and destroy, that these alleged ghosts are actually demonic spirits describing themselves and disguising themselves as ghosts. And yet, when you read the Bible, you yourself get mixed signals. Yes, you do see in places such as Deuteronomy chapter 18 that there is a command not to ever contact the dead. And yet, King Saul did just exactly that. We read about that in the book of Samuel. In fact, he contacted the prophet Samuel after Samuel passed away. And it looks like the real Samuel came to him at that time. We will discuss this provocative question later on in today's program. First, some commentary about the news of the day. Here's what I have to say about that missing plane from Malaysia. I know you've been staying up at nights. You've heard everybody else talk about it. You're wondering what your old pal Bob will say about it. Are you ready? Are you ready? Here is what I have to say about the missing plane from Malaysia. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nobody knows anything. Maybe they never will, but they certainly don't know now. It's not that I'm uninformed. I watch the news. I watch these 24-hour news networks. How fun it is to see these expert talking heads begin with the disclaimer that we really don't know, only to go on for 20 minutes to an hour about exactly what it is we don't know and what it might in fact be if only we did know. Well, Greta, let me start by saying that nobody knows at this point, but I have an idea. Well, I have an idea too. My idea is that I sure am getting sick of this subject. Not the families. My heart goes out to the families of the victims or alleged victims. We still don't know even their status. My heart does go out to them. My heart does not, however, go out to the talking heads. Now, if you want some real news, there is some news that hit the fan this week with actual, factual conclusions that could be drawn. For example, those who believe that a father has a right, in fact, as much right as a mother, to watch his newborn child come into the world, those who believe in the father's rights received a stark awakening from a recent court decision. A New Jersey Superior Court judge ruled in February that a mother is entitled to bar her child's father from the delivery room while she goes through labor. Privacy was offered as the official reason. The parents in question were unmarried and had a strained relationship. Defending his decision, the judge offered legal precedent by way of case law. This is what he said. A finding in favor of plaintiff for both notification and forced entry into the delivery room would in fact be inconsistent with existing jurisprudence on the interests of women in the children they carry pre-birth. Does this sound like a lot of double talk? I'll continue. It would create practical concerns where the father's unwelcomed presence could cause additional stress on the mother and child. Moreover, Such a finding would also lead to a slippery slope where the mother's interest could be subjugated to that of the father's. And the judge referred to two cases, Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Those two cases together eventually overturned state laws forcing women to inform their husbands of any decision to have an abortion. The comparison to abortion is significant. Those who are bothered by the eroding rights of fathers ought not be surprised. The handwriting has been on the wall since 1973's historic Roe v. Wade ruling. Up to now, most of the debate regarding abortion has bounced back and forth between the rights of a mother to protect her own body and the rights of an unborn infant inside her body. The rights of the father, on the other hand, have somehow been lost in the shuffle. Many who call themselves pro-choice make an argument that amounts to little more than the geography of the baby. Supposedly, while the baby is inside a mother's womb, it is hers and hers alone. The father has absolutely nothing to say in the matter, and yet, miraculously, after birth, the child is every bit as much the father's. Should he himself think otherwise, he is threatened with a palimony suit. If there's any consistency here, it would take quite the microscope to find it. Even when a husband and wife decide together to have children, the woman can change her mind after she becomes pregnant. The man must accept her decision. Bottom line, a woman has a right to choose parenthood. A man who also wants to be a parent is subject to the whim of his wife or possibly girlfriend, depending on their situation. In point of fact, this debate about abortion is not really a man versus women's issue. I know the media portrays it that way. But it's not a man versus woman issue. It's an issue that sharply divides women from other women and sharply divides men from other men. Indeed, the most outspoken leaders in the right to life movement are women, even though our liberal media would prefer to quote some loudmouth male preacher from the pulpit who denounces abortion. Okay, look, whether or not an unborn child is truly a human life with rights of its own should be the only pertinent question. If the baby is alive, then we know whether or not abortion is okay, don't we? If the baby is alive, it's not merely some tissue being removed. If the baby is alive, the baby is not property. That would be slavery. It's a human being with its own dignity and its own value, be that as it may. Since those who justify abortion generally express discomfort when the rights of the unborn baby come up, and instead make the issue one of maternal choice, well, then the question of paternal choice becomes a fair discussion, especially with the recent New Jersey ruling pushing the rights of the father even further away. Now, even a woman who decides to carry her baby to full term can claim that the father has no business being in the delivery room. And yet, the moment she takes the baby home and wants dad to chip in with the bucks, it becomes very much his business. There was a time when double standards were corrected by courts. These days, courts have become the canonization of the double standard. Now, ladies, women who are out there listening, before you jump to the conclusion that I'm here only to defend men, before you jump to the conclusion that I don't care about women's rights, before you jump to the conclusion that I'm here to condemn any woman who has had an abortion, I am not here to condemn anybody. Condemnation is not the message of Christianity. The message of Christianity, love. The message of Christianity, forgiveness. And the message of Christianity is about mercy. Besides, I suspect that many women who have had abortions are already being a lot harder on themselves than I could ever possibly be. God does forgive you, but have you forgiven yourself? That's the question that I would leave you with today. Very few women who have had abortions truly understand that they were taking a human life. I know that. The doctors know. Oh, they know exactly what they're doing. But sometimes when a person has circumstances leading up to the abortion, leading up to the sexual activity that might have eventually brought about pregnancy and abortion, I understand that people sometimes will think with their feelings. Many people have felt abandoned. Many have felt abused. Many have felt alone. Many came out of families where they received little, if any, love from their parents. So they took affection in any form it came from any person who offered it. I understand this. And this applies to many people with many varying experiences, not merely those who have had abortions, but anybody who grew up with an open wound, perhaps brought about by a lack of affirmation in the home. Ideally, your parents were intended to serve as a model of your heavenly parent, the God of the universe, the God who loves you, the God who would have come down and died on the cross if you had been the only person in this world, the God who was in fact thinking of you on that cross. But if your earthly parents did not love you unconditionally, how hard it is to accept a heavenly Father who loves you unconditionally, even though he does. The dysfunctional family was excellently portrayed in the brilliant and popular musical. It came out in the 70s, but it's been revived many times, and recently they did a great number from it on the television, the hit show Glee. This musical is called A Chorus Line. In this beautiful, insightful number, composed by Marvin Hamlisch with lyrics by Edward Klaben, three women auditioning for a dance show are asked by the director to open up about their childhoods and about the pain that gave them a love for theater and eventually caused them to view theater as an escape from their childhoods. It's called Everything Was Beautiful at the Ballet.
Daddy always thought that he married beneath him. That's what he said, that's what he said. When he proposed, he informed my mother it was probably her very last chance. And though she was 22, though she was 22, though she was 22, she married him. Life with my dad wasn't ever a picnic, like a come as you are. When I was 5, I remember my mother dug earrings out of the car. I knew that they weren't hers, but it wasn't something you want to discuss. He wasn't warm. Well, not to her. Well, not to us. But everything was beautiful at the ballet. I started ballet class. Up a steep and very narrow stairway to the voice like a metronome. Up a steep and very narrow stairway. It wasn't paradise.
It wasn't paradise.
It wasn't paradise. But it was home. Mother always said I'd be very attractive when I grew up, when I grew up. Different, she said, with a special something and a very, very personal flair. And though I was 8 or 9, though I was 8 or 9, though I was 8 or 9, I hated her. Now different is nice, but it sure isn't pretty. Pretty is what it's about. I never met anyone who was different, who couldn't figure that out. So beautiful, I'd never live to see. But it was clear, if not to her, well then to me, that everyone is beautiful at the ballet.
Every prince has got to have.
Their marriage. But when my father came to pick my mother up at the hospital, he said, well, I thought this was going to help, but I guess not. A few months later, he left, and he never came back. Anyway,
I had this fantastic fantasy life. I used to dance around the living room with my arms up like this. And in my fantasy, there was an Indian chief. And he would say to me, "Izzy, do you want to dance?" And I would say, "Daddy, I would love to dance." But it was clear when he proposed that I was born to help their marriage end well. That's what she said. That's what he said. I used to dance around the living room. He wasn't born, not to her. It was an Indian chief, and he'd say, "Izzy, do you want to dance?" And I'd say, "Daddy."
Now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170 or KPRZ 1210 if you're listening at 2 in the morning on Saturdays. And if you are listening, then you can be sure I'm asleep, but I hope you enjoy the program and its replay. This is Bob Siegel, of course. I'm going to read to you a tweet that came out last week. Congressman Daryl Issa's behavior was crude, wrong, racist and mean toward Congressman Elijah Cummings. Do you agree? Congressman Elijah Cummings, of course, is an African-American. Daryl Issa, of course, is white. Those were, I'll give you three guesses. The first two don't count. Those were the tweeted words of longtime popular civil rights leader, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Now, Was the Reverend reacting to a racial slur? Was he protesting the introduction of a bill to bring back Jim Crow laws? No. You see, Jackson may think he follows in the tradition of the Reverend Martin Luther King, but this particular protest wasn't about civil rights. Now, it was an important incident. It's not that the incident isn't important in its own way. It is, but not for the reasons Jackson suggests. His tweet was in reaction to an intense moment on Capitol Hill. This was a couple of weeks ago, immediately following former IRS official Lois Lerner's second round of testimony, and we should put the word testimony in quotes, testimony before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. After that, all hell broke loose between committee chairman Representative Daryl Issa and the committee's lead Democrat, Representative Elijah E. Cummings. Lerner was in charge of the IRS division that delayed or stifled nonprofit tax-exempt status to applicants representing Tea Party groups, pro-life organizations, or other conservative causes. After she herself came clean and actually admitted to singling out these groups, Lerner then did an about-face by asserting her First Amendment privilege instead of answering questions at a 2013 congressional hearing. Later on, she resigned her post. Well, Lerner was recalled before the same committee just 2 weeks ago. And this time, her attorney, William Taylor, had promised something much different in anticipation of her second coming. But instead of something different, every person in the room experienced something like deja vu. Lerner once again pleaded the fifth. In fact, she pleaded it again and again and again and again by answering every single question exactly the same with exactly the same words. On the advice of my counsel, I respectfully exercise my Fifth Amendment right and decline to answer that question. Well, Chairman Issa was not going to stand for such a mockery of the hearings. Instead of allowing Lerner to act out more repeat performances than Les Miserables, he decided to adjourn the meeting. But this ending turned out to be a new beginning as the room was treated to another encore performance, this time from Congressman Elijah Cummings. Cummings said, "Mr. Chairman, you cannot run a committee like this," and he said it sharply. Issa did not seem interested in hearing more. Cummings continued only to find that his mic had been muted. "We're adjourned," Issa said, obviously annoyed and disappointed in Lerner's refusal to cooperate. "I don't care," Cummings continued. "The fact is, I am asking a question. I am the ranking member of this committee, and I want to ask a question. What are we hiding? What's the big deal? May I ask my question? May I make my statement?" Well, okay, finally, Issa permitted Cummings to ask his question, but you know what? He never asked anything. He never asked anything. Instead, the exchange morphed into arguments about whether Cummings was really asking something or simply looking for an excuse to speak. After the break, we'll have another chapter of As the Stomach Turns in Washington. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. We're talking about what went on in Washington a couple of weeks ago in this corner, Congressman Issa, in that corner, Congressman Cummings, who, when these meetings, which were a farce, were called to conclusion, said he had a question, but when given a chance to ask his question, instead made a statement. That happens all the time. People say they have a question. They don't want to ask anything. They want to talk. They want to talk. And again, as I said before the break, finally, Issa permitted Cummings to ask his question, but it just turned into an argument about whether Cummings was really asking something or just looking for an excuse to speak. So at this point, the committee's Republicans walked away, walked out of the room to the sound of hisses and boos from Democrats. Folks, you couldn't write this stuff for a movie. Issa himself stayed behind, but not for long. He allowed Cummings one more chance to prove that he had a genuine question. Cummings responded to the opportunity, and here's what he said. You see if you hear a question in here. If you will sit down and allow me to ask a question, I am a member of the Congress of the United States of America. I am tired of this. We have members over here who represent 70,000 people. You cannot just have a one-sided investigation. There is absolutely something wrong with that, and this is absolutely un-American. Did you hear a question in there? I didn't hear a question there. Issa didn't hear a question there. Issa said, we had a hearing. It was adjourned. I gave you an opportunity to ask a question. You had no question. Then he, too, darted out of the room. This was a bad day for our country. It demonstrated a complete breakdown in a system where both parties are supposed to put their biases aside and work for the common good. But that particular problem is not what upset the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Oh, no. You see, the default setting of Jackson's agenda is to accuse people of racism, or let's see, oh, yes, more racism. It's amazing how Jackson finds racist motives simply because a white man, Issa, and an African-American man, Cummings, simply because they have a disagreement. Oh, it's got to be race. Got to be race, right? Ladies and gentlemen, let's all put on our thinking caps. Is it possible? Is it even remotely possible? Does it exist in the faintest recesses of your imagination that maybe, just maybe, Issa was concerned about other things? Aren't liberals the ones always lecturing conservatives about how they should stop being so simple-minded and instead deal with the nuances and complexities of life? Wednesday's madness represented quite a bit of complexity, quite a bit of nuance, the overlapping of many important issues, one on top of another. We are talking about an IRS out of control with possible links to the White House. Then we have the Justice Department, which seems to show microscopic interest. And then there are serious legal questions, because the last time Lerner went before the committee, she first insisted that she was innocent of any wrongdoing, and then she took the Fifth. Now, can she do that? Can she testify to her innocence, only to then claim the right to remain silent? Doesn't that give her a chance to say something and then not allow anybody to question her? Is that even allowed? Is that even legal? Well, lawyers are haggling over that question. As for there being no love lost between Issa and Cummings, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to explain Issa's behavior. Issa was annoyed because for the second time, Lois Lerner wasted the time and money of taxpayers. As a result, he was not interested in listening to Cummings pontificate once again about the alleged unfairness of the hearings. But none of this matters to Jesse Jackson. Some racism! That's what it is. And whereas Jackson invited his Twitter followers to offer their own opinions, he himself was not sharing an opinion. No, this was a fact. This was racism, period. End of discussion. Well, that's one way to look at it. Or maybe the more appropriate word would be race baiter. Yes, Jesse Jackson is a race baiter. His tweet was shameless and despicable. Many Americans will see it that way. If they're Republicans or other types of conservatives, they too will be called racist simply because they say they see it that way. I mean, after all, if Chairman Issa is a racist for challenging Congressman Cummings, then obviously anyone who challenges a civil rights leader such as Reverend Jackson is also a racist. I mean, he's a racist on steroids. Even if such a challenger enthusiastically supports the likes of Herman Cain, Alan West, Ben Carson, Mia Love, Condoleezza Rice, doesn't matter. Today's definition, and get this, write this down or type it into your iPad. Today's definition of racist is anyone who dares to speak against liberal agendas, Democratic politicians, or Democratic-controlled divisions of our federal government. That is the new definition of racist. And this is a tragedy. It waters down the word racist, the real word, what it's supposed to mean. It waters down the word racist, people, to the point where people no longer take the word seriously. And ironically, this enables the real racists, as in the story of the boy who cried wolf. The next time a man like Jesse Jackson discovers real, honest-to-goodness racism, who's going to take his cries of justice seriously? In any event, racism is only one example of many evils. Jackson's tweet distracts from this current IRS scandal, which is evil, an evil every citizen, black or white, Democrat or Republican, should be taking seriously. Well, if you'd like to weigh in on any of this, of course, you can always catch us on the phone, but these days, many people on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, S-I-E-G-E-L.net. And I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook because I have stepped into the 21st century. I may have done a kicking and screaming, but I did do it. Now, Erica on Facebook follows my radio show regularly. In fact, she's listened for years. She's written me before. She's called in before. And she usually agrees with me. But this time, in talking about the monologue at the top of the show, the judge's ruling about husbands not being allowed in the delivery room if their wives or whether they're married or not, fathers not being allowed in the delivery room if the mother doesn't want them. She says, Erica says, sorry, Bob, but I disagree with you on this one. Oh, that's okay, Erica. It had to happen sooner or later. Believe it or not, I am acquainted with the phenomenon of people disagreeing with me. As a matter of fact, it happens quite often. Erica continues, it has only been recently that men have been allowed in the delivery rooms. When we get to the body of her letter, I'll read it straight through, but some of these little comments at the beginning, I'm going to respond to them while it's fresh in my mind. So she's saying it's only been recently that men have been allowed in delivery rooms. Okay, well, Erica, that fact in and of itself does not comment on the right or wrong of the situation. All that means is that until recently it wasn't allowed. It's a neutral statement. She continues, first of all, not all women want the father in the delivery room, whether they are married or not. Whatever happened to healthy boundaries? Will women be accompanying their man into their doctor office to have warts removed from uncomfortable places to see their man get a prostate exam? Now, Erica, you're a very bright person. I know that from other comments you've made, which means I know that you know there's quite a difference between a wart and a newborn baby brought into the world by both the father and mother. Erica continues, often there are very good reasons why a woman would not want her husband or her current baby daddy or ex-boyfriend slash father of the child in the delivery room. Let me explain this by sharing some aspects of my personal story, which is similar to other women I have met. I was married but separated from my husband due to the fact that he assaulted me when I was pregnant. He wanted to be in the delivery room for the birth. I said no. His manipulative and controlling behavior, which the assault was just an outward expression of, caused more emotional abuse than I could take as a couple. The safe delivery of the baby and the health of the mother is the most important thing here, not the presumed hurt feelings of an aggrieved man. Would you say that the women in this case had a right to observe the ex-boyfriend undergo a medical procedure simply because she was the mother of his kid? Well, no, Erica, I wouldn't. But once again, the idea of his body, his choice, or her body, her choice, does not apply because the baby is a separate human being, a separate body, and both parents are equally involved with bringing this new human being into the world. Erica continues, From this and other accounts I have read on this story, the woman fully acknowledged the dad's paternity and was willing and did in fact allow the man to visit the infant in the room afterwards. We will continue with Erica's comment and my response when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. Educateforlife.org.
Welcome back to our program. I'm reading a lengthy email, but an important email from Erica, who normally agrees with things I say, but she's derailing today because she does not agree with my commentary about the judge who ruled that a mother can decide whether fathers are allowed in the delivery room. So she continues. Erica says, "I do not believe that being present at conception or during labor and delivery is what makes a man a father. I was adopted and did not lack for love and my dad's provision for my health and welfare." Well, that may be true, Erica, and I think an adopted father is every bit as much, if not more, than a biological father who's irresponsible. I totally agree with you, but I think that's completely beside the point. Anyway, she continues, "Sounds like the man still wanted to be in charge of the relationship and could not take no for an answer, so he sought help through the courts. He should have saved the money spent on lawyers' fees and instead fixed up a special place in his own place to make a home for the child when the baby is with him. Presence at the birth is not needed to be a good father, and women who choose not to have a man around during labor and delivery should be respected. I also know women whose husbands told them in advance that he forbid the woman to have pain medication. The women in question had to get the doctor and nursing staff to forbid the dad from even going into the room so that she could feel free to receive pain meds during labor. The relatively new practice of men in the room during labor and delivery is not welcome by all women. Men should know that if they do not want to be or do not want to see the birth, then they do not have to, and there will not be emotional fallout. Women should know that they do not have to include the husband in that exact moment, and it should not be viewed as unreasonable." Okay, so let me respond to this. First of all, Erica, I am very sorry that you yourself had to interact with an abusive man. Nobody should ever have to go through that. And naturally, Erica, any sane person wants to see laws in place that prevent an abusive father from coming into a delivery room, or to prevent an abusive father from being in the life of the mother or family at all, for that matter. I don't think it's just about the delivery room. If he's abusive, he shouldn't be in the life at all. But passing laws which say no father is allowed makes the tail wag the dog. Saying no father is allowed without the permission of the mother, that's a whole different matter. Just because two people don't get along, that doesn't automatically make one of them abusive. It just means they're not getting along. Or just because a woman has some personal discomfort with having the father there, that doesn't mean he shouldn't be allowed in. If the child is as much his when it comes to responsible and financial obligation, then it's as much his when it comes to the mother's obligation to let him in the room. Watching my daughter Elizabeth being born and holding her in my arms was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. Now, in my case, my wife did want me in the room. But if there is a man who has never been violent and has never been abusive in any way, and yet his wife, for some reason, still does not want him there, I'm having a difficult time seeing why this is a matter for the courts to assert themselves. In any event, I do thank you, Erica, for writing and reading the column and listening to the show so regularly. And I always do appreciate your comments, even though we obviously don't see eye to eye today. And this is from Paula on the same subject. Paula says, I think in cases of domestic violence and abuse, this ruling protects both mother and child. When a relationship is healthy, there is no need to bar the father from participating. Certainly, this type of ruling has the potential to be abused, just as any law can be abused. Think stand your ground laws. Keep in mind that judges don't rule on such cases to hurt and harm people. These types of decisions are made because someone is currently being harmed or hurt due to the lack of law in place. It's too bad we don't respect each other enough to understand that sometimes privacy is necessary. Too bad we need rulings and laws like this to have adequate control over people who have no control over themselves. Okay, well, I appreciate your comments also, Paula. For such abusive situations, I believe a restraining order can be obtained. Incidentally, Paula, and I guess not just to Paula, I'm saying this to everybody, there are abusive mothers too. You're all aware of that, right? And abusive wives, you watch the news, you've met such people. There are women who hit their husbands. Now, I know that sounds like a joke, because if there's some great big hulking guy and this petite little woman and she's hitting him, it doesn't look like he's going to get hurt. And physically, he's probably not, but you can hurt a person's spirit. Some men, in fact, I think this would be true of any decent man, any man with a few scruples would never strike a woman for any reason. A decent man would never strike a woman, even if she strikes him. They've done studies of this. There are some women who take advantage of that. There are also women who neglect their children. There are women who take harmful drugs while they're pregnant. There are women who beat their children. So what if a father knows that the mother is abusive? Maybe she's already been abusive to some of the children being born. She's having another one. Should he go into the hospital and request that she be made unconscious while a cesarean section is performed so that only he can witness the birth? Now, does that sound like nonsense? Of course it sounds like nonsense, because it is nonsense. Face it. With the exception of some type of restraining order, or maybe a state determining, regardless of delivery room situations, that one or more parents are simply not fit to be moms and dads because of abuse. Other than that, the courts should just stay out of this. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you're thinking most women who wrote in disagreed with me, think again, most of them agreed. Let me read a few. Olivia on Facebook says, it's all a continuance of the toxic effects of the feminist movement's marginalization of men in our society, particularly of fathers. It's sickening. But Tanya also agrees with me, and I'll show you how much she agrees when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Comments from a few women that wrote in regarding this whole case of the judge saying that husbands are not allowed in delivery rooms if the wife doesn't want them, or boyfriends of the girlfriend. And some agreed with the ruling, some disagreed. Tanya says this: so basically, the woman who is the innkeeper, so to speak, can tell daddy, you can help me make the baby, deal with my hormones for 9 months, pay for this child until adulthood. Some don't, but that is not my point. But you may not watch them take their first breath and come into this world. I am certain there are circumstances that it is needed for, but this is paternal. How could you deny a participating, notice I said participating, father the right to be in the delivery room? I do not understand this at all. The government has no business making this kind of decision, in my opinion. Well, my article about the delivery room was nothing compared to the controversy generated by my article about Jesse Jackson. And you already heard the monologue version earlier in this show. In my online column, Forbidden Table Talk, carried now by Communities Digital News, there were well over 100 comments following it. The piece also caught the attention of Mark Stein, who was substitute hosting for Rush Limbaugh that day, and put a link to my story on Rush's website. You can read these many comments by accessing my column online, but I'll give you a sample from the column itself and a few Facebook followers. Renee on Facebook says, rather tongue-in-cheek, I don't know about that, Bob. Sounds racist. And he puts a little smiley face by his comment. Renee, my friend, a sneeze sounds racist these days. Liam says, Jesse Jackson wouldn't have a career if he didn't regularly accuse people of racism. Charles says, biggest racist in the world that needs to try to divide racial barriers further to make himself feel important. Now this idiot racist needs to look at his own life and quit cheating on his wife and teach his kids not to steal from the public. A racist will always use the race card, not to mention he is trying to stick up for another racist. All right, we're going to move on now to some Bible questions and comments about some of our heavy theology shows that we've had in these last few weeks. This is from Brian, who listens to us in Texas, referring to John 14:2, where Jesus says, in my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? Now, it's interesting. He says it would definitely be too bold for me to say. In other words, Brian's saying, boy, Jesus had a lot of brass. I couldn't say this. He says, Jesus sounds cocky. But then Brian seems to quickly observe, but he kind of validates his work when he says, if I hadn't done this, why would I have told you? He doesn't actually ask a question, but I'm assuming he wanted me to comment on that. So here's my comment. Brian, if Jesus were a mere man, then that would have been cocky indeed. But his claim was that he was actually God incarnate, who took on the form of a man. The second person of the Trinity emptied himself of the form and power of God and became a man so that he could have complete empathy with human beings. For this reason, when you pray, Jesus is sympathetic to what you go through. He too struggled. He was tempted to sin. He never gave in. No, he never gave in, but he was tempted. So he understands when you're tempted. Of course, his other reason for becoming a man was to die for your sin and my sin and rise from the dead. And when he talks about rooms in heaven, it's just his way of saying, because you have been forgiven, you get to enjoy heaven with me for all of eternity. Brian, thank you for writing, and thanks for listening all the way out in Texas. Now, Will listened to my debates with Pastor Brennan about Calvinism. Will says, very well done and timely, as it seems there is a strong resurgence of the whole tulip thing, almost to the point of excluding non-tulips from the body of Christ when taken to the extreme. He's talking about Calvinists who would say, if you're not a Calvinist, you aren't saved. Now, my guest and opponent did not take that extreme view. But what he means when he says tulip is an acrostic. It stands for the 5 points of Calvinism. We went through them on that debate, but they stand for total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace and perseverance of the saints. As I mentioned during the debate, I accept only one of those, the last. Perseverance of the saints. I do believe that once a person has given his life or her life to Jesus and become born again, they cannot lose their salvation. Will also says he appreciated the mutual respect shown, and I heard that comment from many people. Steve in San Diego says, hey, Bob, great job with those two Calvinist debates. And then Steve goes on to say that my guest really stretched a point by trying to redefine what it meant for Jesus to die for the whole world, and in doing so, support the Calvinist doctrine that Jesus died only for the elect. And he says this guy denied the very plain, obvious meaning of 1 John 2:2, which I brought up several times. 1 John 2:2 says, he is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, and not only for ours, but also the sins of the whole world. And yet Pastor Brennan tried to make it look like Jesus didn't actually die for the whole world. This verse looks clear. It does look clear, and I'll tell you why it looks clear. It is clear. Christine in San Diego also says, I listened to your Calvinist debate and also had my friend and her son listen, and they really enjoyed it. She is on the other side of the fence, but doesn't consider herself a Calvinist, but does believe in predestination, that we don't come to Christ until we are called first. Well, Christine, I'm glad that despite her believing in predestination, she was willing to listen to another side and be challenged. That's very much to her credit. And again, I do agree that nobody can come to God without the Holy Spirit first doing a work in their hearts. But I do believe we are able to respond to it. And I so much disagree when Calvinists teach that the work of the Holy Spirit is irresistible. If it were irresistible, then the resistance of the Holy Spirit would not be described in the Bible as an unforgivable sin. How can we claim his work is irresistible when the same Bible says, but if you resist him, you've committed an unpardonable sin that even Jesus didn't die for? Now, Christine also has some interesting questions, and I don't know if we'll have time for both of them today, but we'll at least do the first one. And I teased you with this at the top of the show. It's taken from 1 Samuel chapter 27. She says, Saul went to a seer, and it was forbidden, but she told him the truth. David had a seer too, but he was a prophet slash seer. Why was Saul doing something wrong and David not? If it was a false seer, then he wouldn't have gotten the truth. What about today with mediums? Can they really call up the dead, the real dead? Or is it always a demon? How can the dead have bodies? Boy, she's asking a lot. I'm not very clear on the sequence of resurrection when we get spiritual bodies, and I had always thought no one received their incorruptible bodies until after Jesus was raised. That's a lot, Christine, but boy, you are really asking excellent questions. First of all, David did not have a seer, but rather a real prophet of God. Saul was seeing a medium. A prophet of God hears revelation from God. A medium is conjuring up power that they think they're attuned to, and it's really coming from Satan. Now, it would be the difference between somebody today prophesying in church or somebody today going to a medium who conducts a seance. Any supernatural power not commissioned from the God of the universe, the real God, Jesus Christ, is of Satan, the master camouflager, counterfeiter, and deceiver, and he wears 1,000 masks. 1,000 masks. It was wrong. Saul should not have gone to the medium. Now, having said that, we can never put God in a box. God had his reasons for supernaturally intervening, and this was the real Samuel who came to Saul. But of course, the minute he came, he rebuked Saul for having dabbled in the occult. So it would be a serious mistake for somebody to read that and then conduct their own probing into the spirit world. In such a case, they would encounter a demon. They would. And this demon might impersonate a loved one who has passed away. Mediums cannot call up the real dead. But again, in the case of Samuel, God supernaturally intervened and allowed the real Samuel to come back and rebuke Saul for using a medium. So yes, in general cases, the medium thinks he or she has contacted the dead, but they really have a demon posing as some dead person. Now, if God chooses to allow a real person who is dead to make an appearance, such as when Moses talked with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, that's different. God can initiate contact between one world and the other, but it doesn't work the other ways. We cannot initiate contact. As for resurrections and receiving resurrected bodies, I'll have to do that next week, Christine. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. The time went by far too quickly. I know you wish your old pal Bob could just be on the radio for 20 hours, but I can't. But I'll tell you what, I'll be back next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.